Okay. What does this poor little child have? Hydrocephalus, Pleiades, stenosis of the aqueduct of Sylvius, okay, which would be communicating or non-communicating? Non-communicating, there you go. The reason why they get hydrocephalus is because the sutures have been fused. See, if you miss a hydrocephalus in an adult and the sutures fuse, then what will happen is you're going to get dilatation of the ventricles. Eventually, over years, the pressure will actually turn back to normal, okay, because the increased pressures over a period of time will keep the choroid plexus from making as much, but the damage has been done, the ventricles and all that are dilated, and you can get dementia and ataxia, related urinary incontinence related to that, and that's called normal pressure hydrocephalus. Trust me, that started out initially with increased pressures, but over time, it normalized. They thought my mom had that, actually, at one time, because she was ataxic, and she does have dementia, and she does have urinary continence, and so they did a ventriculogram. They put a dye into her ventricles, and they were dilated, and so they actually were thinking of doing a shunt on her, but they decided against it. Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale said, it's not worth doing. Okay, so they just let it go. All right. This is a tuberous sclerosis, which is autosomal dominant, and it has a lot of interesting parts to the disease. It has a lot of different hamartomas. Remember, those are a proliferation, a non-neoplastic proliferation of things. And so take a look at the ventricles here. Do you see anything kind of weird on these things, on the ventricles? Kind of see that bump there. Look at that, there's a bump there, a bump there, a couple bumps. These are called tubercles, okay? And that's where the part of the name of the disease occurs from. Basically what they are, little hamartomas, where you get a proliferation of astrocytes, and they produce these little hamartomas that can bulge into the ventricles, and sometimes they call it candlestick drippings. They look like candlestick drippings. They get hamartomas of the kidney called angiomyolipomas. They also have mental retardation. They have those cardiac tumors called rhabdomyomas. So it's a very interesting group of diseases that one sees, and commonly asked on boards because it's relatively common. Chagrin patches. These are little areas of hypopigmentation. They're kind of hard to see. And so they recommend that you get a Wood's light, and they shine out. You know, it's not that they're an infection, you know, due to fungi, but they show up better under Wood's light. These what they call chagrin patches that are also seen in tuberous sclerosis as well. So this is kind of ratty looking brain, isn't it? Not very normal looking, that's for sure. Okay, this is the worst of the open neural tube defects. This is anencephaly. Okay, where you have an absent brain. I'm sure that when you went through your neuroanatomy, they talked about the vertebral arch defects, like the little one that's usually down at the base over here with a little tuft of hair coming out, spina bifida occulta. Okay, that's where there's just the vertebral arches don't quite touch each other. There's no meninges or anything coming out of there. A little dimple there, not a whole lot to worry about. But then if it's a little bit bigger, then so maybe the meninges can come out, maybe not the cord, that's called meningocele. Or if it's even bigger, meninges and the spinal cord come out, myelomeningocele, that's very bad. But even worse than that is anencephaly. Now remember, what's the alpha fetoprotein levels in the blood of the mother? They're high, okay? And if they're decreased, what is that? Down syndrome, okay. Do you have to be on folate before you get pregnant to prevent open neural tube defects? Yes. Because remember, the neural tube is finished by, what, 26th to 29th day, somewhere in there. And so most of the time, a woman doesn't even know she's pregnant by that time. So it's already finished. And so it's too late to take the folate to prevent it at that time. That's a very common board question there. You've already seen this. Remember, that's Sturgey Weber. Okay, now I'm going to show you these two pictures here, and you're going to tell me what this patient has. That's Cafe au lait, very good. That's a Cafe au lait spot. And you can see this brown pigmentation in the axilla. It's called axillary freckling. There's a couple neurofibromas there. This is also neurofibromatosis. Remember, there's a movie called The Elephant Man. These are called plexiform neurofibromas. It exemplifies one of the things one sees in autosomal dominant diseases. We've mentioned late manifestations, and that's certainly true for neurofibromatosis. Penetrance, it's not manifesting that in this particular case, but the other one's variable expressivity. Now, what does that mean? Basically, what it says. It says that you are expressing the disease, but there are different levels of severity that can be seen in that same family. These two were brothers, okay? And this is all this dude had. He just had a Cafe au lait spot and a couple little neurofibromas, little axillary freckling. That was it. But yet his brother, with the same autosomal dominant disease, had a much worse manifestation of it with these plexiform neurofibromas making it look like elephant hide. Okay, so that's what the term variable expressivity means. That the disease can have different levels of severity. You're manifesting it, but there can be different levels of severity. It's mild to very, very severe. So let me give you a couple ways they've asked the question. They put this picture up, actually, and it said he had hypertension, and then they said, what test would you get? So you have to know there's a relationship of neurofibromatosis with pheochromocytoma, so what would you get? 24-hour urine for VMA or metanephrines, whichever one they stuck down there. Okay, this person here had central neural hearing loss. What's he got? An acoustic neuroma, which involves, it's a benign tumor of Schwann cells of what nerve? Eighth nerve, okay? Those were the two they asked. That's about the only ones. Other brain tumors that they get are meningiomas and also optic nerve gliomas. They get a benign tumor of the optic nerve. Actually, that's the most common overall aspect. They love neurofibromatosis. You can go to any mall in this country, and if you stick around there long enough, you'll see people with these little nodules all over their face and their body that have neurofibromatosis, very common disease. Okay, Cafe au lait. Is that topic mnemonic of neurofibromatosis, Cafe au lait? Nah. You can have other things like this. There's a thing called... what is the name of that thing? It produces precocious puberty, Albright syndrome. Precocious puberty, Cafe au lait spots, and bone zits. Polyostotic fibrous dysplasia, to be exact. So it's not pathognomonic. They're kind of coffee-colored, non-raised lesions that one sees. Cafe au lait spots. Sturgi Weber, we've seen already. Syringomyelia, I know that... I'm sure Nandan went over the different kinds of spinal cord lesions that you get. Here's the way they ask syringomyelia. They'll talk about a person that works in a factory, and then one of the factory workers says, you're burning your hand, because they were touching something and their hand was smoking, and the person didn't feel it. Okay, and then they said that examination of the patient revealed loss of musculature and the internal intrinsic muscles of the hand, and had absence of pain and temperature sensation along in a cape-like distribution across the shoulders. Sometimes they put that in, sometimes they don't. Most of the times they don't. They just put in the lower motor neuron types of things with the intrinsic muscles of the hand, and then they put this thing in about the lack of, they can't feel pain. That's the way they usually do it, actually. And what they're trying to get you to put down is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. They catch a lot of people because you were taught that the first place that ALS usually develops is in the intrinsic muscles of the hand. And if you can see mine, they're lost. Okay? I lost them. And I forget how many years ago. It was many, many years ago. I had EMGs. I had fasciculations all over my body. And I was told I had lower motor neuron disease. Then I got healed. Which was cool. That's another story. But I still got a little remembrance of what I had there, you know, with the loss of intrinsic muscles in my hand. I haven't lost them there. I did lose them here. Okay. So, remember, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis is an upper motor neuron, lower motor neuron problem. It's pure motor. If you lack pain, you can't feel pain, that's sensory, guys. That would never be amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. That's motor and sensory. Because it's this big cystic cavity in the cervical cord that's knocking off your spinal thalamics, that's your pain and temperature. Then it can knock off upper the cortical spinal tracts. It can knock off your anterior horn cells. So it's going to be a combination of sensory and motor. ALS is pure motor, no sensory. Part two starts fiddling around with the bladder. Okay, they start talking about some motor weakness down in the lower extremities and bladder problems. That's syringomyelia, because patients with ALS have no bladder problems at all because there's more sensory. Okay, so that's what they usually do on part two. We already talked about Arnold Chiari. We already talked about Dandy Walker. It kind of sounds like a horse, doesn't it? This sounds like a good drink after dinner drink. Just like I'm going to have a Bud Chiari as soon as I get home. Okay? And then I'm going to follow that with an Arnold Chiari, and I'm going to go to a horse race and bid on Dandy Walker. Okay. All right. Infections. This is what meningitis looks like over here. Okay, let's make sure you understand how you're going to recognize meningitis from encephalitis, something that mundane. Meningitis is inflammation of your meninges. You can have nuchal rigidity. Okay, if you move your head or if you raise that leg up like that and extend the knee and you stretch that meninges, it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt because you're stretching inflamed meninges. Encephalitis, I want you to think of sleeping sickness. What do you know about sleeping sickness? They sleep. In other words, they're always sleepy and drowsy. They have mental status abnormalities. They don't have nuchal rigidity. That's meninges. So people that have mental status abnormalities and are sleepy, they have encephalitis, not meningitis. And that's how you're going to tell in the stem of a question, you know, what you're dealing with. Okay? So this is what the pus looks like, and you can see this is at the base of the brain. So what's one of the dangers? If this was pus at the base of the brain, can you see possibly that it could maybe block off the Lushka Magendie, and there would be a problem of obstructive hydrocephaly, or non-communicating, huh? You understand that when you treat meningitis nowadays, they use steroids and antibiotics, don't you? Do you know why they use steroids? That used to be heresy in the old days. They'd say never use steroids in treating a bacterial meningitis. Why are they doing that? The steroids is to prevent scar tissue formation, guys, and all those complications associated with meningitis that relate to scar tissue formation, hydrocephalus and stuff like that. And so it cuts down on that from happening. And so they're willing to take the risk of putting them on steroids as well as antibiotics. Now, it's always been standard treatment in TB meningitis. I mean, I remember way back when I was going to school, anti-tuberculous drugs and steroids were always given. That's because TB in the brain is incredible. It produces intense scar tissue in there, and also infarctions. It produces a vasculitis. And to stop that, you had to put them on steroids as well as anti-tuberculosis. So that was standard therapy way, way back there. Now they do it on any bacterial meningitis to prevent some of the complications. Deafness is one of the more common complications of meningitis. They go deaf, sensory deafness. So this is meningitis. This is a cerebral abscess over here. I showed you that one before. This is someone that was rabies. Okay, I finally figured out what the most common cause of rabies is in the United States. It was only in one book. Okay, what do you think it is? Raccoons? Nope, that's actually, raccoons is here in the Jersey, New York area. Bats? That's way down the list. Dogs? That's the most common one in your countries. Not our country. That's true too, actually. Dogs is the most common cause in third world countries. Fox, no, that is in San Francisco area where you expect foxes to be the ones to cause something. Coyotes in Texas. Zebras, that's really good. The answer is skunks. Skunks is the answer. It's in that current issues thing where the internal medicine comes out every year. Okay, that big blue book with the orange on it. I think it's Lang series. And there it was, guys. They broke it all down by places. And it was in Jersey, it was raccoons, coyotes in Texas, foxes in the San Francisco area. Bats wasn't even listed actually down there. And then, but all the other areas of the country, it was skunks. Skunks was number one cause. So that's the most common overall cause of rabies in this country, is skunks, not bats. And these, of course, Negri bodies, okay, in a patient with rabies. That's a Purkinje cell. That's an inclusion. That's rabies. Now, you all learn about this one, but I want to see if you can recognize it. This kid, when they were, this kid has a congenital infection, okay? And when they took an x-ray of the brain, they saw a peculiar abnormality. The kid died, and this is the section, it's the brain in that kid. Don't look at me, you're not going to be able to get the diagnosis looking in my eye. I don't have this disease. Very good. This is periventricular calcification. It's white stuff here. You can see it right there. It's going around the ventricles. See it right there, going around the ventricles. There it is right there. It's CMV, cytomegalovirus. Cytomegalovirus. Periventricular calcification. It's due to encephalitis. And then it gets dystrophic calcification there. Now, CMV actually is the most common congenital infection in kids. And here's another board question for you. What body fluid is the most productive to culture to diagnose congenital cytomegalovirus? Urine, that is correct. Urine is almost guaranteed growing it there. Okay, growing it out there, that's correct. Okay, that's good. Okay, this is the periventricular calcification. Now let's do meningitis. I can almost bet, I'll even bet that you were taught something different than what I'm going to tell you by your microbiologist on meningitis. I'd literally almost put money on it. Okay, but I won't, because I'm very cheap also. If I came home with less money in my wallet than my wife gave me, I'm going to get in trouble. Remember, I told you I was codependent. But anyway, she will ask me. She will check it, because she put exactly $100 spending money for me, and I've hardly spent any. She's going to be very proud of me. But anyway, maybe they told you this. What's the most common meningitis in the first 1 month of life? If they said E. coli, you knew they were in frontier land. Okay, that taught you. Answer is group B strep, Streptococcus agalactiae. It's the most common cause of meningitis and sepsis in a newborn. Main reason for that is that many women that are pregnant have the organism in their vagina, in their carriers. And so if they have premature rupture of membranes, it goes right up there and get a chorioamnionitis and eventually gets into the kid's bloodstream. By far and away, that's numero uno. Number two is E. coli. That used to be number one back then. Number three, they've been asking also, and that's Listeria monocytogenes. What should all pregnant women not eat? Soft cheese. Soft cheeses, like feta cheese, are no for pregnancy because Listeria monocytogenes is present in soft cheeses. That's one of the most common locations. Remember also, it's gram-positive with tumbling motility. Now, gram-positive rod with tumbling motility. Who else has tumbling motility? Trichomonas vaginalis. And so does Listeria monocytogenes. So soft cheeses, all of those have been asked. Now, from 1 month to 18 years of age, it's Neisseria meningitidis. If they said Haemophilus influenza was in there, then they were in frontier land when they looked up that information. That's probably one of the least common infections there is now because of the vaccination. It's Neisseria meningitidis from 1 month to 18 years. Beyond 18 years of age, it's Streptococcus pneumoniae. So actually, it's pretty easy to remember. So if they talk about a 52-year-old man that has nuchal rigidity, a spinal tap is done, reveals increased protein, increased neutrophils, decreased glucose, and they're going to say, you would expect the gram stain to show. They've had gram-positive coccus, gram-negative rod, you know, all that kind of crap, gram-negative diplococcus, gram-positive diplococcus. What's the answer going to be? Gram-positive diplococcus. That's how they'll do it. They're not going to put strep pneumonia. They're going to see if you know what it looks like. Whoa was right, huh? Okay. Alright. Indian ink preparation. That's it. Narrow base butt. See that? What's a broad base butt? What's like but? Blasto. Blasto, very good. Okay. The reason why India ink works is because, like Klebsiella pneumoniae, it has a big mucus capsule around it, so does Cryptococcus. Pigeons! Alright, just wanted to make sure. Cryptococcus! Alright, you're good both ways. This is very, very good. Your reversible biochemical reactions. This is very good. Okay. Now, who do you think this was in, this Cryptococcus there? Would have to be an immunocompromised patient. So what's the most common acquired immunodeficiency in the United States? AIDS. AIDS is the most common acquired immunodeficiency condition. And Cryptococcus is the most common cause of meningitis in AIDS patients. That's correct. You saw this already. This is mucormycosis. So this was in the frontal lobe of somebody. Who was this patient? Diabetic in? Ketoacidosis. Very good. Now this is a special stain that was done on an AIDS patient who had a 50 helper T cell count and died. He had a CT showed a multiple space occupying lesions in the brain, and so they did the stain on these cysts, and the diagnosis is toxoplasma. Okay, this person is married to no. This person is a sheep herder. No, this person is not a sheep herder. This person, how am I going to get this one, is a pig herder. Okay, this person takes care of pigs and has had a long time problem with focal epileptic seizure activity required dilatant therapy. And so they did an autopsy on the brain, and there were these multiple cystic and calcified lesions in the brain. What does she have? Cysticercosis. There was a young lady, she was Greek actually, in one of my meetings that had a grand mal seizure. Thank God I wasn't actually there, because I would have been frantic. Okay? So was everybody else who were watching the poor thing moving around and this and that. And it turned out she had cysticercosis, and the medication she was on was making her too tired so she couldn't listen to my lectures properly. She was falling asleep, so she cut back on the dose of her medication so she could hear me, only to end up with a grand mal seizure. That's going too far for me. That was not good. So we told her, please go back on that thing, you know, and she did fine. But she had cysticercosis of the brain. Okay, remember some of the other ones you're going to need to know is Jakob-Creutzfeldt disease or Creutzfeldt-Jakob, whichever way you want to say it. What's the transmissible agent? Prions, okay. So who would more likely get this disease? Neuropathologists, particularly if they're stupid enough not to put gloves on their hand, and most of them are, okay? And they don't, and you can end up with problems. So could neurosurgeons get this disease? And then, of course, you can get it. This is the mad cow disease thing. You can get it from foods. What was it for? Beef, wasn't it? Undercooked beef or something like that. Also, they got it from some lettuce from... lettuce from Arizona, and I know exactly where it was. Yuma, Arizona is the most biggest lettuce place in the United States, and I know for a fact also, having driven by there, that they use cow manure for their fertilizer. And of course, cows, manure, using it for fertilization, I mean for what do they call it? Fertilizer. And the people did not wash the lettuce properly, I guess, and it was contaminated with the Jakob-Creutzfeldt thing, and they ended up with getting disease that way. That you're going to get a question on Jakob-Creutzfeldt for sure. I think that's enough. I can't think of anything else that's important CNS-wise. These are your two traumatic lesions of the brain. This is an epidural hematoma, so let's make sure you understand how you're going to recognize it. What's this? That's a dura. Well, it looks to me that's sitting on top of the dura, right? It's not under it, is it? It's on top of it. So what does that mean? Epidural. So you tell me what happened to this dude. Got whacked in the head right over here in the temporal parietal lobe. And you know there's a blood vessel that goes to the bone there called, don't pick middle cerebral, middle meningeal. And so you have to fracture the bone. You cannot non-fracture. It has to be fractured. And then it avulses the artery. And then under arterial pressures, you are able to separate the dura away from the periosteum. And it takes about 6 hours. I actually counted this. I wonder who sacrificed himself to know, find something like that out. And then when you get about 50 mLs of blood, you end up with an uncal herniation, you die. So you usually get whacked, you go down, you get up, you say, I'm all right, 6 hours later you're in the morgue. That's an epidural hematoma. Now, I love showing this to second-year medical students because they think the pathology is this guy was probed, hit with a probe right in the brain, like this, you know. And they get totally fixated on this device over here that to get that it's actually holding this giant blood clot over here that's actually covering the whole surface of the brain. They completely miss the fact that this is the undersurface of the dura. See, if we took that top and I brought it down over here, you wouldn't be able to see that. It'd be absent. You would see absolutely nothing. But then when you reflect it back, you see this giant blood clot over here, and the undersurface of the dura is stained by this blood. This is a subdural hematoma. This is where you rupture the bridging veins between the dura and the arachnoid membranes, these little tiny veins. Now, if you happen to have cerebral atrophy like most alcoholics do and most older people do, and that space between the dura and arachnoid membranes is greater. And so those bridging veins are just dangling in the breeze. So just a little bump, they break, you get a blood clot that usually covers the whole convexity of the brain, and you got yourself a problem. You have fluctuating levels of consciousness. Left untreated, these can end up with dementia, and as you know, big time losses. See, the reason why ER people, when they have head traumas, always do a CT, is to rule out stuff like this. See, MRIs don't pick up blood too well, but CTs do. And so they do that to rule out an epidural and or subdural hematoma because it picks up blood. That's also true for strokes, okay, because whether you're going to put a patient on heparin or not depends on whether there's blood there. If there's blood there, you're not going to put them on heparin. Okay, and so they have to see if it's a hemorrhagic type of stroke, and the best way of doing that is a CT scan on multiple things. MRIs are worthless for that. Speaking about strokes, here's one. You can see this side of the brain is bigger than this side of the brain. Looks a little bit more swollen. This is a close-up view, and we can see the gray matter looking okay here. Then all of a sudden, it looks like it's breaking down over here. We look in here. You see some breakdown here of the white matter. I think you can see that. This is an atherosclerotic stroke. There's no hemorrhage in this. There's four strokes, and this is the only one that is consistently has no hemorrhage in it. This is a pale infarct of the brain. The problem is right down here in the bifurcation, there's a big old atherosclerotic plaque that was probably pretty much occluding the lumen, and then a platelet thrombus developed on top of it, and there was no blood flow to the brain. And so the brain infarcted, okay? And so it starts breaking down, and because there's usually no reperfusion that occurs, usually the thrombus doesn't dissolve, it remains a pale infarct. If the thrombus did break apart, and you reperfuse the brain, and that blood gone into the area of infarction, and this would have been a hemorrhagic infarction. But the majority don't reperfuse, and that's why they're using pale infarcts. So when they have patients with these kinds of strokes, the CT's looking for this, and they would say there's no hemorrhage in this, and this patient would therefore be a candidate for heparin therapy in their stroke. Now this is what would happen over time if this patient survived. You've seen this before. They'd end up with a big cystic space wherever that area of infarction was. Remember, this is an example of liquefactive necrosis. So this is an infarct, pale, liquefactive, not coagulative necrosis. Now everything else from now on will be hemorrhagic. I want you to look real careful at this and at this. These are two different things. I want you to notice over here, the blood you notice is right to the edge of the brain. That's a very key. In fact, this almost, if you look at it, almost has a wedge-shaped appearance to it, doesn't it? Almost. And it went right to the edge of the brain. This is an embolic infarct. This usually is an embolus, maybe arisen from the left side of the heart, and it embolized. Now, the vessel that it will almost always go to when you embolize from the heart is it'll go into the middle cerebral artery. It gets into that circle of Willis and right in the middle cerebral. If you embolize down here, it's just going to go right into the superior mesenteric artery. Just the way they're angled. It's almost always middle cerebral in distribution. Okay, now the reason why this is a hemorrhagic infarction, while the atherosclerotic stroke wasn't, is that you will get breakdown by the fibrinolytic system of the embolus and you get reperfusion of this area. Now, instead of it being a pale infarct, it's a hemorrhagic infarct. So both a stroke, an atherosclerotic stroke, and an embolic stroke are both infarcts. One's pale, one's hemorrhagic. Now, you've already seen this one, did you? In what context? Hypertension. And we went over this, that this is the classic picture they put on boards here. And we said that in hypertension, the pressures cause the lenticular striate vessels, which are tiny little suckers. These derive from the middle cerebral. And they kind of come up and they supply this area of the brain here. They form these aneurysms called Charcot-Bouchard aneurysm. This guy, Bouchard, is pretty important, isn't he? Then we call a Bouchard node over here. So he's a pretty sharp dude. He's in the brain. He's in the whatever. Okay. So what happens is the aneurysm ruptures. And this is a big, giant blood clot. This is not an infarct. This is a giant hematoma, blood clot, in the brain that's literally pushing the brain aside. These things have a horrendously bad prognosis, but nowadays, as I told you, they can suck some of this crap out and they get a little bit better prognosis. So we have, this is an embolic stroke because it went to the surface of the brain. When you see a clot like this kind of in the area of the putamen, basal ganglia area, it's always an intracerebral bleed, it's always hypertension. Last one, we've already seen a big old subarachnoid hemorrhage, and most of these are due to a ruptured congenital perianeurysm. Most commonly, they're at the junction of the anterior communicating branch with the anterior cerebral artery. This is an AV malformation. Okay. If this is an AV malformation, I already showed you a disease twice, actually, that I said had, on the same side as the skin lesion on the face, had a AV arterial venous malformation. What was the name of that disease? Sturge-Weber. Very good. Now look at this over here. Do you see anything wrong with this brain? Say yes. Why? It's pathology. Very good. Okay. Yeah, little thing there. Where is this? That's in the internal capsule. Okay, I don't know if Nandan went over this with you, but these are called lacunar infarcts. And these are very unusual kinds of infarcts because of the fact that they hit little small areas of the brain. And depending on where on the internal capsule, you can have a pure motor stroke, we're going to have a pure sensory stroke as opposed to combinations of the two. So pure motors, pure sensory kinds of strokes are these little tiny infarcts called lacunar infarctions, and they're most commonly due to hypertension. Hypertension, little tiny things. Look at this real careful, please, because this is the absolute best slide of this, and the one most commonly used on boards. You're looking at the most common demyelinating disease in the United States. It's autoimmune. Now, I want to ask you a question here. What matter is that? Gray matter. What's this? White matter. Well, isn't this white matter in here? Well, how come it's gray over there? And it's gray over there, 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 and there. Why is it gray there when it's supposed to be white matter? It's been demyelinated. See, white matter has myelin in it. Gray matter doesn't. And so if you're destroying myelin, then what you'll see is gray matter underneath. Okay, so these are the plaques that they call of multiple sclerosis. Remember, there's two ways you can demyelinate something. One, you can knock off the cell that makes myelin in the brain, that is, oligodendrocytes in the peripheral nerve, that is, Schwann cells. That's one way it can do it. Viruses like to do that, like measles. You know, it's like slow. These slow virus diseases, subacute sclerosing, pain encephalitis, progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, that papillomavirus, those infect the oligodendrocyte and produce demyelination that way. But you can also have autoantibodies against myelin and destroy the myelin sheath, not the oligodendrocyte, and that's multiple sclerosis. Remember, this one is the one that every medical student thinks that they have sometime or another when they hear this, these little bzzz here and little bzzz there, little paresthesias. you know, their butt falls asleep when they're on the toilet and they think they got some kind of MS, and when they really just, you know, blocking off the sciatic nerve, okay, and stuff like that, and they get a little bzzz here, a little bzzz there, and all that, you know, think, ooh, the paresthesia, oh my God. And then things get worse from that point on, and, you know, then different other things happen as you start hyperventilating, get circumoral paresthesias, and all of a sudden you're twitching, and you say, oh my God, I got the disease. The medical students had just about every disease in the book when you heard about it, right? I got that. I got that now. I mean, it's just one of those things. You know, we are really bad because we know too much. We know too much. I always think the worst when something bad happens to me. I've got it. Finally got it. And I just know. And that's why I never want to go to a doctor. There's some people that will go to the doctor right away. There are other people who want to deny it. Just deny it. And you have to drag me to a hospital, to a doctor. I will never go to a hospital, that's for sure. Why? Because you're there. Okay. That's the main reason. Not you personally. Doctors are there. That's the absolute most dangerous place in the world to be. And this is the truth. It is a hospital. There's a really, really good chance you ain't going to come out of that hospital the same. I'm serious. My wife and I have agreed 100% we will never go to the hospital. We'll just stay home and die. We promise to help each other and keep each other, you know, happy until the end. But no hospital. No hospital. Okay, so I always think I've got, you know, this and that, and then I go there and they come up with this explanation I never thought of before that makes sense, and all of a sudden you walk out singing in the rain, you know, everything's just wonderful, you feel so good, you know. I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me. Well, this is multiple sclerosis, and it's got all kinds of things. One of the things, for example, is nystagmus. They get ataxias. They get optic neuritis with blurry vision. That's a big one. Most common cause of optic neuritis is multiple sclerosis. It's a demyelination of the optic nerve. Then there's this one that probably Nandan taught you. I can't obviously show you this, but I can tell you what's happening. They say, look to the right. So the patient looks to the right, and they have jerk nystagmus on the right, and the left eye is still looking at you. Then you say, look to the left, and look to the left, and there's jerk nystagmus on that one, and the right eye is still looking at you. What's that? That's someone that doesn't trust you. Okay? Good. Now, what is that? That's internuclear ophthalmoplegia. Okay? And it's absolutely pathognomonic of MS because you have demyelination of both sides of the medial longitudinal fasciculus. That is absolutely pathognomonic of MS. Okay? Absolutely pathognomonic of MS. Okay, anything else on multiple sclerosis? Yeah, you do spinal taps on these patients, so have an increase of protein. Glucose is normal. Lymphocytes increase. Those are the lymphocytes associated with the autoimmune disease, the cytotoxic T cells. And that's pretty much it for MS. Okay. All right. That look like it's a normal brain? No. I mean, don't look like a whole lot of cerebral cortex there. And it kind of looks like this is called, they call this hydrocephalus ex vacuole. It's where you have such severe atrophy of the brain that it looks like the ventricles are actually bigger than they should be. So they did some sections on this kid, on this guy's brain. He's over 65. He had dementia. And they did a silver stain, and they found the absolute classic lesion that defines what this disease is. This is called a senile plaque. And it's neurites over here. And if you did a Congo red stain, it would take up the stain, and there would be amyloid right in the middle of that. And I want you to tell me what the name of that amyloid is. Beta amyloid protein, that is right. This is the senile plaque. So the middle is beta amyloid protein, and around it are neurites. And this is kind of showing you that the amyloid, beta amyloid protein is toxic to neurons. Because look at this, look what's left of them over here, and there's the amyloid there. So the more you have in your brain, the more damage you have to neurons, the more dementia you have. And because it's synthesized from chromosome 21, this protein, that's why Down syndrome patients all have Alzheimer's disease by 35 to 40 years of age. So this is actually pathognomonic of Alzheimer's. Neurofibrillary tangles are also present, but you can see that in any type of dementia. And also, I think I mentioned to you Huntington's chorea. You can see that. Remember, this is a higher intellectual function problem, which means that they have problems with memory predominantly. They can't remember anything. You know, you give them repeat, 136, and then they can't repeat that. And so it's actually a clinical diagnosis. You have to do psychological testing. The only way you can confirm Alzheimer's is an autopsy. And so if you want to know whether your parent or somebody you know really has Alzheimer's disease, you have to have an autopsy done at death. Okay, don't do it while they're alive. Okay, at death, and see if you can find the neuro, the senile plaques, and then you can confirm it. Otherwise, it's really presumptive diagnosis. It's purely done by clinical testing. Anything else I want to say on this that's new? No. What's this guy got? Parkinson's. Now, I don't know why they would show you the fingers, because I'm sure they're trying to show you a resting tremor, but do you see any?